not needing those huge audiences anymore, not needing to be on 50,000 downloads a week to get an advertising deal. When you can build a sustainable income because you've got 1,000 people who are willing to support you.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, we're chatting with Cassie Delaney, the founder of Outcaster.io and also the founder of Tall Tales. Cassie is a fascinating entrepreneur. She is out to change the face of content and specifically how content is distributed. Exactly for people like me who produce a podcast or a series, you can sign up to Outcaster.io and monetize your content almost instantly. It's an incredible chat. We chat about the future of content, what that looks like, how it's about to completely shift. We also talk very seriously about sexism and discrimination faced by female founders, and how difficult it can be to raise money. And we also talk about Cassie's story as an entrepreneur, how she's evolved from working in a large tech organization to becoming an entrepreneur multiple times over. It's an incredible chat. It's funny, it's serious, it's insightful. I hope you enjoy my chat with Cassie Delaney. As always, this podcast is brought to you by Sage. Sage are the number one provider of payroll, finance, and HR software to small and medium-sized enterprises all across the world. To learn more about Sage, click the link in the bio below. Now, onto my chat with Cassie. Cassie, welcome to the pod.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm weirdly nervous because I know you know everything about podcasts.
Oh, I wouldn't say that now. Every day is a learning day. Well, I'm nervous because you're like the king of interviewing entrepreneurs in Ireland. And I'm like, what am I going to say now?
It's all been said. Just leave it there. Welcome to the pod. I'm genuinely delighted to have you on.
Thank you so much. It's a real thrill. It's so nice to be in someone else's studio and behind the mic here and not having to worry about the edit or the video or the uploading afterwards.
I know. I'm trying to think about 10 things at once. Welcome. What, I guess, give people a flavor of what you do. We've kind of hinted at it there.
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is a content creator. I've worked in Irish media for too many years. Like, I had my first media job when I was 19, working in magazines, and I've worked my way through kind of every facet of Irish media. A couple of years ago, then I set up a production company called Tall Tales Podcasts, and we would have produced some of Ireland's most loved podcasts. We worked with the likes of, you know, Georgie Crawford, Brian Dowling, The Creep Dive. And that was great. Like, loved production, loved creating content. But it took me to kind of the start of 2020, and I started really looking at how content is monetized in Ireland and globally, how content creators are sustaining themselves, and started really looking at the tech behind content and where content could meet tech to build more sustainable businesses and more sustainable lifestyles for people. And that's what led me to found Outcaster, which is now a content marketplace and hosting platform for all types of media creators that allows content creators to quickly design and deploy their own apps and sell content directly to their fans.
I like it. It's going to be like a content therapy session for me.
That's it. I mean, we were talking at lunch. I was like, we'll never get off the topic of content. I have so many thoughts about, you know, how content is performing at the moment, the issues with it, what's happening with creators. Creators is the, you know, the kind of SMEs and how we need to start thinking of creators. And then also the big gap is the creator middle class. Like, it's a huge, huge issue. It's the, you know, 96% of content creators that aren't making enough money to sustain a living. And they're the people we're interested in working with and really helping.
You mentioned Georgie Crawford there. Her growth has been explosive. Phenomenal.
Absolutely phenomenal. But like, not even Georgie, a lot of the content creators we work with will have come from very small followings, just got into podcasting in the early days and have had huge, huge growth and really created some. Podcasting is a beautiful medium for people. It's very forgiving and it's very intimate. Like, I always say this about podcasts. You get people where no other media type can. You get them when they stick their phones in their pockets and they go for walks, or they're cleaning their kitchen, or they're having a shower and they've got your voice blaring out in a speaker somewhere, or they're driving their car, you know? And because of that, you build these like amazing relationships with your audience members. They really feel like they know you and they really are very, very loyal to you. So it's no wonder the podcasting has experienced such growth over the last couple of years, because it feels like you're listening to your pals, you know?
I forget what I say on the podcast because I do it today and we have a chat. We often gets quite deep.
Yeah.
I'll reveal personal stuff. And then 3 months later, you might meet someone and they'll reveal that to you. And you're kind of like,
when did I say that?
Oh, yeah.
It gets me in a lot of trouble. It does. Yeah. Because you lack, and especially when you're in an environment like this, where you're sitting down across someone interesting and you're having a chat, you do kind of, you know, get into something a little bit deeper, but no other medium allows you to do that. Even here where we're filming and we've got the cameras, they're really nice and neat in the corner. I'm looking you directly in the eye. We're having a conversation. You forget everything else around you. And that translates then to the listener as well, who feels like they're just eavesdropping on a, you know, a conversation between pals. So it's a really, I always say it's a really forgiving medium. You know, you can make mistakes in podcasting that people will get over. If you had the same cuts or the same mistakes in video, people would stop watching. It would be jarring to watch, but you can create a really succinct, beautiful podcast that people feel like is recorded from start to finish without any cuts.
Yeah. Like the intimacy, I think, is the thing. Yeah. I think that's what I like about it as well, because it is really nice to do it. Yeah. You just sit down, have a really in-depth chat. And the bonus is other people get to listen.
That's it. And you're very rarely double screening when you're listening to a podcast, because you're usually listening to a podcast when you're doing something else and your hands are busy. You're totally fixated on that piece of content.
So bring me back to the early days. How did you get started?
Started with Tall Tales.
Yes.
So I had years of experience working in media, and my most, I suppose, I had a media job where I was working for kind of a well-known name in Ireland who were producing a daily publishing website, multimedia kind of stuff. We were doing videos, we were doing editorial content. I won't name the company, but
I was just going to say, you sidestepped that so beautifully.
They had two gendered websites, you know, so they were very, very big at the time. And at the time I worked there, they were, you know, the kind of biggest publishers in the country for a certain demographic of people. And it was there that I started really noticing the growth of podcasting, but we weren't doing it. And I remember going to them and pitching a couple of different shows that were turned down because they wanted big names. They believed that typical content thing that you need to have someone with a big name to launch a new show for people to listen to it, right? And we were kind of, myself and my colleagues were saying the opposite. We were like, no, if you get the content right with podcasting, the audience will come and the audience will grow. But we were kind of hit, you know, it's that classic gatekeeping thing in media that you're like constantly waiting for permission to be able to do the thing that you know will work because somebody holds the keys to the website or the distributor or the audience or whatever it is. So I ended up leaving that job and working then in a startup that had just raised their Series A, which was fantastic. I went in there as the director of content and started leading out their content and marketing teams. And that was absolutely brilliant. I'd always been interested in tech, but that was great to be like really at the forefront of an Irish company that were thriving at the time. Like they're still a fantastic company, but like particularly at that moment in time, lots of news articles about them, lots of eyes on them, lots of funding. Team was growing rapidly and we were really at the core of creating a strategy that would see them grow. So learned a lot there and kind of stayed there for 2.5-3 years. But in the background, I started producing podcasts. So I started making them with an ex-colleague, Megan Cassidy. We made a podcast called Before Brunch. And we saw the audience growth in it and it was brilliant. We had this incredible moment where we had an advertiser come and sponsor us and turn down sponsorship on a podcast in the place we used to work with to come sponsor our podcast. And that was my real, like, I knew I was right about this. I knew we were onto something here.
So was that you testing the theory? Was that you kind of going, right, let's just see what happens?
Yeah, but I knew, like, I think as a content creator, you always have to trust your consumption habits as well. Like you always have the answers. So I knew what I was listening to and I knew what my friends were listening to. And I knew it wasn't this personality driven media name type stuff. It was always content stuff. It was like, you know, it didn't matter if you knew the host or not. It was the concept of the podcast that drew me in. And I knew that to be the case. So it was really great to be able to test it. So as I was working for the startup, I was producing a lot of content in the background. And eventually I had more and more people approach looking to produce content, looking to produce podcasts. So I made the leap then and started Tall Tales, went out on my own. So
talk to me about that moment, because that's the moment a lot of entrepreneurs struggle. That's often that crossing that chasm is often too great a challenge for them.
Yeah.
How did you know it was the right time.
Well, to be honest, I've always had a very good relationship with the CEO of that company that I worked for. So I approached him and I told him that this was my intention, and he allowed me to go down to part-time. So for the kind of the last 3-4 months of me working there, I was able to build up a client base and have the income of the job, which was brilliant. And it was enough to kind of see me through and help me get started with the first studio and build up that client base. Now, when you jump out on your own as an entrepreneur, it doesn't matter if you've had 6 months part-time work and you've built up a client base, something will happen and something will go wrong. Like, I think I was in the new studio like 2 weeks when a client changed direction and I lost the work. So I was like, right, you're kind of back to depending on yourself. But that definitely, to anyone I say who's considering the leap from employment into, you know, self-employment, whether it's freelancing or entrepreneurship, it's to build up that base. It's the typical stuff you see. You need to have 2 or 3 months of bills in your account before you can really make the leap and do it, because something will always happen, or something will, you know, be expensive, or you'll crash the car, or you'll need a root canal, or something will pop up. So it's, if you're not prepared, that stress is the thing that will drive you back to full-time employment. But if you can kind of have a little safety net, you know, that really, really helps. Takes the edge off the job.
That's cracking advice, because there's such a false narrative out there of burn the boats, you know, go all in. If you don't go all in, you'll never make it, blah, 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 blah. And you're the second entrepreneur I've spoken to today, and you're the second entrepreneur who has said, look, you need a plan.
You need a part-time.
He had done the same thing. He had, you know, bootstrapped it up. He'd had some money from other incomes. Like, often people do it in tandem. And if they're really smart like you were, they'll do it in tandem with their existing job, but find a way.
Absolutely. Like, you can find a way as long as you sit down and plan it. Like, if you make a proper plan for it. I hate these stories you often hear as an entrepreneur, especially in the arena that we've gone into now, which is like very much a tech focused company, and we're seeking VC funding and all that kind of stuff. You hear this advice is like, you have to spend the money like you already have it. Like, you have to power on, you have to do this, or like, you have to just make it work. And I was like, but how do you pay your bills? Like,
you can't fake it till I make it with the ESB or whatever they're called now. Airtricity aren't going to go, no problem, Cassie.
Give us
a shout there. We'll put that on the tab.
You'll never get a landlord who's like, all right, that's grand. You're going to make
Sound.
It someday.
Oh, you're faking it now. Okay,
I'll let your rent accrue. Like, fair enough, some staff and founders, you can allow salaries to accrue and things like that, and people are flexible. But you'll have cold, hard bills at the end of the day that you need to cover. And for the reality for most entrepreneurs that they don't talk about is sometimes either that's if people aren't working as they're trying to get something off the ground, like working part-time or picking up consultancy work or picking up odd jobs on the side, then the likelihood is that they come from quite privileged background where they have, you know, either family money or some like income or some sort of money there privately that they can live off as they do it. But in order to really, really make it work, you have to understand that, like, you need to either save a lot of cash to be able to get yourself off the ground going, or have that night shift work in the background, or have something that you can turn to earn money off. And it's not a failing to have to do that. That's just the reality of the situation.
And it's almost sneered upon. It's almost kind of looked down upon. They're like, oh, you're not all in, right?
Yeah.
You've nailed it there with the privilege thing, because I think there's either a false narrative that they look backwards and go, oh yeah, you know, I knew I went all in, and I knew it's irresponsible
to completely.
A point, because you're burning. Okay, it's grand, just you. But being alive as a human, you have a cash burn.
Of course you do.
You have a cash burn. You can't just live on nothing. You have to eat,
you
know, generally rent, or if not living at home, whatever it is. But you just have, you have a burn of 500 to a grand minimum just to be alive.
Minimum every single, you walk out the door and something pops up. You either have to buy your groceries or whatever else, or you've got your gym membership or whatever it might be. Everyone has expenses they have to cover. And if there is anybody telling you they just made the leap and made it work, they're not being honest, you know?
They're the worst type. They're the ones you just run away from. Or they're the coaches. Just run away from all them.
But I think that is a really dangerous narrative, because if you make the leap and it doesn't work out for you, you're not generating enough, you know, if you're not generating enough cash in the first couple of months, you start to feel like a failure and you start to think this isn't going to happen, because there is that false narrative that you're following. But that's impossible. Nobody makes a leap into entrepreneurship and covers their costs you know, or covers their previous income from day dot.
A friend of mine has a great phrase. He goes, it'll take you twice as long and cost twice as much.
Yeah.
And I'd say that's underestimating it.
Yeah, completely.
3, 4, 5 times maybe as long. We talked about this about content as well.
Yeah.
I love the comparison between content and business because I think they're the same. Mm-hmm. I think that the principles of good content are the principles of good business.
Absolutely. And what I was saying to you earlier on during lunch is one of the things that we I think strive for these days in content and in business are these great overnight success stories. Like you want to have your TikTok metrics where you've gone viral, or you want to be that startup that has raised, you know, or is valued at over $1 billion in less than 18 months. Like there's some fantastic stories out there, but the real key to success and sustainability and building a sustainable career for yourself is time plus consistency equals success. So when it comes to podcasting and content, it's about allowing enough time to pass that audiences are aware of your content and can grow. You know, I think that patience is one of the key ingredients for an entrepreneur, I think. And we forget that often as well, because we only ever see the overnight success stories, not the kind of ones that are ticking away in the background.
Well, no one wants to hear that story.
That's it.
It was absolutely backbreaking work for 10 years.
That's it.
And then we kind of made it.
But when you see companies like Teamwork, who raised like a huge amount last year, but they had been bootstrapping it for years and years and years before that, and no one had heard of them. That they're the great stories. Mm. They're the ones who was like, actually, I can ignore all this startup VC noise and I can focus on my company. And we started out, like even we were saying earlier on when... with Outcaster, when we switch it on, the first day we switch on Outcaster, I know that we will make a minimum of €25 because we have clients who are on an MVP who are going to go, and on average, one podcast will make about €25 a day. And I'm buzzed for that.
Yeah.
Because that will only grow. Like, you know, it'll only compound over time. And that's what I'm excited about. One of the best pieces of advice I got actually when I was doing the NDRC Accelerator last year was like, you don't really have anything until you have a profitable business. You know, you look at the companies who are raising and amassing huge investment rounds, but may not be profitable yet. And even if it is only €25 or €50. Of course, it's not enough to cover your costs, but you have a product that works if people are willing to pay for it.
And that's the point. Mm-hmm. 0 to 1.
Yeah.
That's the famous Peter Thiel book, but it is incredibly powerful to go from €0 to €1.
Yeah.
Because often, and it's not talked about a lot of startups don't even get that far.
They don't. They don't get there. But they get a lot of funding and they get a lot of press and they got a lot of good news stories, but you know, not anyone can't go in and raise a load of money, but like you can burn through a lot of cash and create a lot of noise. But if you don't have somebody paying for your product, then what is it?
Adam Newman. Mm. Anyway.
That's it.
Going back to, you made a really great point at lunch about timing. Mm-hmm. We talked, if we were sitting down here 24 months ago, it'd be a very different conversation about timing. So you went through the NDRC and as you were going through it, were things changing?
I'm
trying to remember the timeline.
I came out of it sort of December of last year. So it would have been on the cusp of things changing. So during the accelerator, which was brilliant, and maybe it's the buzz of the accelerator, but also the buzz of the markets, you could definitely raise a seed round. Even in Ireland and internationally, you could be looking to raise a seed round of 1.5 million, 2 million, and you were able to raise that on a story. And I saw it happen for some of the companies that were around the kind of ecosystem who, you know, pre-seed and seed funding, you could get funding at pre-revenue stage based on your story, based on your data, based on your market research, based on your product and your team and what you were going to do. And it was enough for a VC to kind of believe in you and say, yeah, we're going to put this money into you to see if you can make this happen. Things certainly changed. You know, at the start of the year, there was a lot of companies who had been overvalued, who had IPO'd and were, you know, operating at much less than what their opening market rate was, which has impacted the funding landscape massively. Not anyone's fault. We've come out of 2 years of pandemic. You know, the world is different. Trends that we're predicting 4 years ago have been all upset. 2 years ago, all upset. Like we were in no man's land. Like nobody knew it was going to happen. Companies that thrived during the pandemic haven't come out of the pandemic performing as well. Loads of companies were just overvalued. But it meant that like the money is just not there for VCs to invest. It's not even a caution. It's just not there. Like to put this into context, I always say this to people. So like, you know, I will put €100 into like a fund and monitor it like a stock fund just to see how it performs. So at the start of this year, I bought €100 of Ethereum and I put €100 into S&P and I watched how they performed. And like you saw Ethereum go down to €36 at one stage. So it's a very interesting, tangible way to understand why VCs paused. They couldn't pull their money out of these companies because it wasn't, the value wasn't there. So they didn't have it to invest. So of course that has impacted the markets, right down to little old me who's sitting down in Dublin trying to get funding for a content startup. So that idea of raising on a story is not there anymore. And I don't think it's going to be back for a really long time. And I actually think that this market shakeup is a good thing because I think for a really long time, startups have been completely overvalued. And it was doing things at speed. Again, that idea that there's not enough time for companies to perform. It was seed, series A, 18 months later, series B, even a year later. And it was all accelerating too fast. So, I mean, if you were watching someone move that quickly in a relationship, like they're insane, you know, like that's mental, carry on. That's like someone like meeting someone, getting married, you know, moving in together, getting married, that, having a baby. You're like, whoa, you're moving way too fast. Like, let's just spend four seasons together to see how this goes. So I think that this market shakeup is going to be a really good thing for startups because you're going to have to value things like time and strategy and performance again in a way that I think that was just overlooked for so long in the startup landscape. So it is interesting. I think if we had launched this company 2-3 years ago, I think I'd be sitting across from you as a millionaire dripping in diamonds. As you can see, I am not. So we are still very much out there trying to raise some money, but we're doing it much further along than we would have been this time last year. Like the product we have now is incredible. We have spent that time with the markets in decline to really think about what this product will look like at scale and future-proof it so that when we do get funding, and I'm confident we will because we've got such a valuable proposition, but when we do get funding, we can grow safely and we can grow knowing that it's going to work and we can grow in line with our strategy that we've laid out.
I think that marriage analogy is one of the best analogies I've ever had on the podcast. So that's getting clipped. I'm going to claim that now for the next year. I heard, we were talking about that over lunch. I was listening to a podcast, they were doing a live pitch thing and the guy was saying, we started two months ago now and, you know, we're now at a market cap of 3 million, you know, and I'm like, how can you have created value of 3 million in 2 months?
But it's crazy. You can't have. I always think you have to, like that, for that four seasons analogy, like you have to see how something performs at every part of the year, how trends that are outside of your control will impact your product and impact your customers and things like that. And building a truly sustainable company is about predicting for all outcomes and all possible scenarios and seeing it. Like to think that companies are achieving that market cap in such a short space of time, the likelihood is that they're basing it on one client, one contract, or a very small fraction of what their customer base is, which again is just foolish and unsustainable. You know, everyone was looking at the market crash at the start of the year saying, who could have seen this coming? And there was a bunch of female entrepreneurs looking at the kind of mediocre men that had been invested in saying, we all saw it coming. We saw it coming. Like, how did you think you could give Adam Newman money and it not happen? Like, how did you think that you could throw so much money into companies that were very much pandemic success stories and think that they would continue to grow after the pandemic, which is the kind of frustrating part. And then you look at, you know, specifically today a fund like A16Z and look at the 350 million they've given Adam Newman for his new startup and think that they're just doing it again. And they are investors in, you know, 80% of the companies that underperformed. So you look at huge, huge funds like that and you're like, of course, it's going to continue happening because you're valuing the wrong things. You're putting the money in the wrong places. You're looking at the wrong metrics. You're not interested in sustainable growth. You're interested in speed. And that's not going to work out.
Does that scare you though, raising money? And then you kind of almost become part of the machine. Does that worry you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does, because you look at stuff like VC funding, right? And it's a huge, huge problem, especially for, say, female entrepreneurs. Less than, I think it's 2.8% of VC funding globally a year goes towards female founded companies. It's an incredibly low statistic, and it's part of a much bigger problem, which is, you know, which is misogyny, which is VC funds are typically investing in the same thing over and over again. It's not diverse, and it's not building a diverse economy. But you have to play with the systems that are in place to be able to change them. There is no other way for us to build out this business than to get VC funding to do it. You know, we could crowdfund or we could do whatever, but ultimately to achieve the growth that we need to achieve to be the company that I know that we can be, it is VC funding. Now, it's sad, I think, that in order for it to succeed at that, you have to be in the top 1%. And luckily, so far, you know, myself and my co-founder, both female, a third co-founder is male, but we are one of those companies that seems to be riding in that 1%, that we are on track to do the funding to be successful. We've been in the NDRC accelerator. We're getting angels in and stuff like that. It's definitely like a crisis of conscience that you're like, I shouldn't have to be the exception for this to work. Like this should be a more equitable system. Like there should be parity here for people. But the plan, and for any female entrepreneurs that I've spoken to, all, you know, share the same vision that, like, as a female entrepreneur who does access VC funding, you put women on your board, you put women on your cap table, then you have female, you know, angels, then you have female funds, then we'll start to see parity that way. Mm. It always takes kind of people to break through the current systems to be able to change it.
That was going to be a question I had for you, because on the podcast, I've tried to have a balance. And mm-hmm. two seasons ago, I was like, great, 50-50, we'll keep this going. Yeah. And I was unable to sustain it.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't getting intros. I'm like, can you intro me to female founders? Can you intro me to female founders? And I was getting, oh no, but like talk to John in this. I'm like, mm-hmm, great. Mm-hmm. But like, can but you?
The stories are
what
different.
Is it though?
Well, I think if you're looking at tech specifically and STEM, it's a very intimidating arena for women. It's very male dominated. It's very intimidating. I've seen it as a founder who's participated in programs and other stuff. It's very hard for women to break through. Do we work differently? I don't think so. I think that women have as strong an idea. But when you look at the makeup of teams that are needed to succeed in that typical VC-backed business tech space, you need to have your technical co-founder. You need to have your, you need to have some level of technical experience or technical expertise to be able to build out a company like this. And you need to be fearless. And it's not even about the fearlessness thing, but like you need to be selfish in a way with it, you know? Like I don't have kids. I have the time. I have the passion for it. I have this almost all-consuming ambition to do this. And I'm very lucky that I'm at a time in my life where I can do that. And I had technical experience enough to speak about what I wanted and the experience to be able to build out this company specifically. I just don't think that women are given the opportunity to do it. And I think that this space, the tech space, needs to be less tech bro-y and more inclusive, which again will only come from seeing more female entrepreneurs do well.
Is there an element of ego and confidence? Because we chatted about this on the way over. I was chatting to a mate of mine who's abroad at the minute trying to build his company, and he's surrounded by wealth where he is. And he's like, they're just no different than me and you. And I text back to him and I said, look, I think we just have low confidence, if I'm very honest. I think we're very similar characters, both very driven, but definitely hold ourselves back due to low confidence. Mm. Do you think there's an ego thing, a confidence thing that men have that just...
Yeah, I mean, like you look at things like the confidence gap, which is the idea that men will apply for any job where they meet about 70% of their criteria laid out in the job description, whereas women won't apply for a job until they feel they meet 100% of the criteria outlined. So I definitely think there are things like that. There's unconscious bias as well. You know, men hire... You like to hire people that you think you're going to get along with. You know, you have that gut feeling where you're like, I can see this person working with the team. But in actual reality, it's because you like what's mirrored back at you. You know, you like to hire and work with people who you are going to get along with.
They remind you of yourself.
They remind you of yourself, all that kind of, and it's not intentional. And for like, there are people out there doing great work to try and break this down and to achieve parity in boardrooms and stuff like that. But I think that there is, you know, there is an issue. Like, we don't have enough women in C-suite positions in Ireland. We certainly don't have enough women on boards. We don't have enough female CEOs, and we definitely do not have enough female founders. So it probably comes down to confidence, opportunity, I suppose even down to college courses and the makeup of different college courses and how women, you know, naturally move towards more nurturing professions and how men go into the kind of engineering, the typical stuff that I hate saying, but it is statistically true.
I'm great to be able to have an open conversation with you, because sometimes I'm kind of like tiptoeing around it because I'm definitely don't want to touch and speak ignorantly on the subject. So it's great to have you on and be able to have a proper conversation about this, because it isn't talked about a lot. Because I've had a female founder sit across from me and she's like, I can't really talk about this because, you know, it'll look bad.
Yeah. And I think there are, like, I have seen some female founders speak up and say, look, you know, VCs are sleeping on female founders and the opportunity that are there for female founders. And you're like, oh, is it, or is the business plan not there? And you're like afraid to step up because then you're opening yourself up to criticism, you know? All I can say is that I think that there is more work that needs to be done in the VC space, right? When you think of things like, funds should be deploying 50% of their available cash to female-backed companies, right? And I know you'll get kickback from people saying, well, maybe they're not the best startups and maybe they're not whatever. But like, when you think about, in order to achieve gender parity across all roles and across companies and across economics, what has to happen is a favoritism towards women, because it's retribution for the opportunities that have not been there in the past, right? So if you think about it, breaking it down again to like really, really simple terms, you know, 50 years ago, women couldn't work and be married, you know, so they didn't have the opportunity to accrue wealth, to pass that on to their daughters, to even to go to college and pass down education and build those systems. Whereas men are traditionally the breadwinners, the sons become the breadwinners, they go to college, that path is defined for them. And for women, it hasn't been there with such clarity. So in order to get to the point where women are in the boardroom and feel competent, you have to kind of give them the opportunities now, which may seem unfair. But the thing is, equality isn't about treating people the exact same. And this might upset people as well. Equality is about treating people in respect to their differences so that everyone has the same outcome, you know, which maybe takes a while to kind of get your head around and really think about it. But that is the only way to achieve parity.
It's great to have this conversation, because I like being able to have open, frank conversations with people who have experience of this. Is there still a sexism as a female entrepreneur?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, absolutely.
That's never said.
I've had terrible things said to me. Terrible things. I've been in situations where I've been at large networking events and been turned away for development roles or like high strategic roles, pushed towards content, pushed towards marketing, been greatly undervalued, have had comments made about my appearance, have asked me when I'll step away and have kids, what's going to happen when I have kids, who'll take over the business when I have kids, who's going to be there, what happens with two female founders, what if we have kids at the same time? It's never ending, do you know?
Really?
Yeah, never ending.
Is it generational?
No. It goes across all generations.
I was just hoping that was the answer. I was like, oh, it's gonna phase out.
Sometimes it comes from places where you really don't expect it.
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes it comes from peers and you're really like, really? We're still doing that?
Is that ignorance, laziness, uncomfortableness, don't know what to say to you? What is it? Is it just ingrained?
I think it's just ingrained, but I think it's a genuine curiosity there. You know, like, I'm in my early 30s. I'm a female founder. You know, people are like, but what will you do? Do you want to have kids? And it's like, you know,
in today's world, that just strikes me so bizarre.
It happens a lot. Yeah, it happens a lot.
Thanks for sharing, because I think people don't. They're like, oh, can't touch it. Can't touch it. Obviously, scene has been like, you know.
Thanks for asking. Difficult. Not many people do. Yeah.
Difficult. Well, it's. I always try to gauge the guest. I'm going to go, how direct, yeah. I wonder they're going to be with me.
Sometimes it's really overt. Like sometimes it's comments made about appearance or it's, you know, you're rolled out in a tokenistic way for different things. And then sometimes it's more subtle. Like sometimes we'll be talking to a VC who will ask to speak to our male CTO earlier than they need to be brought into the conversation. Right. Do you know? It's like, well, you know, you don't need to speak to him at all. Like I'm telling you the strategy. I designed this business. I came up with it. You know, he's building the stuff. Yeah, it's collaborative, but like he's building things that we've decided on as a trio. No one in this business gets to go away and make decisions on their own. Like we are three people, two women, one man, and we all make the decisions together. So, you know, if a fund kind of comes back and asks, you know, when they want to speak to the CTO, I kind of write them off a little bit earlier. There was a great moment on a webinar, and it was a kind of female founders session webinar, and there was a Q&A, right? A Q&A box. And the
so
women,
it was a female founders webinar.
And there was a Q&A box, and I could see the answers going, I see the questions going into the Q&A box, and there were questions like, will you commit to the round before other things come in? But there were like really legitimate questions. Mm-hmm. And the panelists have been asked questions about gender parity and that kind of idea that VC funding goes to less than, you know, 2% or less than 3% of women globally every year. And one of the people from the organization said, might it be worth bringing a man into the pitch? And it was just silence. We're like, like any man, should I bring my husband or my father? Which one should it be? You know, like it was unbelievable. And this was really, really recently. Like this was, you know, at a time when the markets were in decline and all entrepreneurs are scrambling for cash and support. But to be told or to be suggested, should you just bring a man into the pitch? I was like, yeah.
That's genuinely eye-opening. Like the height of patronizing and the height of sexism. Yeah. Well, rolled into one lovely little comment.
Yeah, yeah.
Whichever,
just bring one in. Just get one off the street and bring one in. They'll give him cash.
It's so demeaning. Like that's just so unbelievably demeaning. Yeah. A thought has struck me as we're chatting about this topic. Is the rise of content creators and a huge amount of them being female, is that because there's no gatekeepers?
Yeah, I think so. So I think that there's a real democratization of content creation. That's the most exciting part of it. Without gatekeepers, anyone can succeed. And it's not even about gender parity. We're seeing a lot more diversity when it comes to race, all types of genders, and people being able to succeed in that space. Because when you democratize content, and this is really what Outcaster is all about. So Outcaster is a system where content creators can build sustainable incomes because they're selling their content directly to their fans. We look after all of the tech that's needed to do that. So we allow content creators to build beautiful websites and beautiful apps to host their content, any type of content, whether it's video, podcasts or editorial content, and to sell that directly to people based on either subscription, once-off micropayments or trial basis or bundles. Like we've made it really, really flexible. When you distill content creation down to who's willing to pay you for the content and not needing those huge audiences anymore, not needing to be on 50,000 downloads a week to get an advertising deal. When you can build a sustainable income because you've got 1,000 people who are willing to support you, that's when we start to see a lot more diversity, a lot more democracy, a lot more people who haven't been given the opportunity to date be able to show what they're worth and to be able to perform really, really well.
So talk me through Outcaster. Let's say, mm-hmm. right, we're going to put the entrepreneur experiment on Outcaster.
Yes.
What does that involve and what does that mean?
So it means a ton of different things. So for you right now, you could sign up to Outcaster tomorrow and you'll receive our creator backend. So from there, you upload your podcasts, your videos, you write your little episode description. Now, you can stick that out there for free and let your audience come across it and consume that in a nice closed environment. So it can be a privatized login where they can log in and listen to your podcast and chat away to each other and have great discussions underneath it. Or you can decide to put that behind a paywall. So you might want to put that on €4 a month or €5 a month where your paying subscribers can log in, consume that content both on desktop and mobile beautifully. And for content consumers, it means that they can go on to outcaster.io. They can browse the world's independent content. So they can see content consumers, the content creators like you, content creators like me, content creators like, you know, their favorite DIY person that's on TikTok, and they can purchase and support their content there. And it all then is consumable in one beautiful kind of mobile app experience.
Is that the future of content? Is that how, obviously you're going to say yes,
yeah.
But are we moving away from this mass kind of like this mass download mentality of like, we must get the numbers up because it's so fragmented. And I was literally at a marketing conference during the week and I was saying, look, it's early doors for podcasting. Mm-hmm. It's still really fragmented. It's really hard to reach people. You know, I have a community and they're over there on that website and then I'm trying to bring them over here.
Yeah.
And the interaction of what you said makes podcasts great is the fact that it's so intimate.
Yeah.
But trying to actually engage with the audience can be really, really hard.
I think that it is the future of content for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's actually the past. So it's the future of content based on trends of the past, right? Do you remember walking into HMV and buying a CD for €20 because one, you know, 10 songs bundled together was worth €20?
Yeah.
And that's what you were willing to pay because you loved. I'm going to look at you and say it was Green Day.
Oh, you know what? I've a very mild taste in music. I'll literally very take anything.
Fair enough, right? So you go on ABBA. You'd go in and you'd buy your...
Foo Fighters, but ABBA's a bit harsh.
Everyone's an ABBA fan, right? So you go in and you buy your CD because you valued that content that much and you had that relationship with the creator and you were like, I'm willing to pay them this or whatever, right? Then we moved into this kind of digital sphere where it all became about quantity and we bundled content together. So when you look at the likes with Spotify, it is like €10 a month and you get as many songs as you want, yada, yada, yada. But you don't have those key relationships. You might listen to a lot more content, but not have those intimate relationships with the creators as much. And it also is problematic because it's devalued content for the creator. Like in 2020, 0.9% of the creators on Spotify earned more than $100,000, which seems like a lot of money. But if you have a team behind you creating podcasts or, you know, the team that it would take to create an album, $100,000 is getting you nowhere. So that system is broken. And what we're doing with Outcaster is unbundling those content bundles again and putting the value back on individual pieces of content or albums or series or, you know, TV shows or whatever, films or whatever it may be, because the appetite is there within the audience to support their favorite content creators. There's 500 million people in the world right now who are currently purchasing content from independent creators who value the creator economy, who understand that content is a cousin of art. You know, like, in order for content and good content to be created, it means putting your hand in your pocket and paying for it. So there's definitely the appetite there to be able to do that. And that is what we're facilitating with Outcaster. We're getting content creators and content consumers to start thinking of content the same way you do when you walk into a shop and you're willing to buy a t-shirt and a pair of jeans, that you should be going onto a website to support your favorite creator and buying their previous album or buying their short film or buying their podcast series for either once-off payments or on subscription if you want to access the content regularly.
That's a super interesting way of thinking about it, because recently I found I just want curation. I only want, not the best, but I don't want to go to a million websites. I don't want to scroll through a million different ads and pop-ups. You go to a newspaper site now and you're like, oh, sweet Jesus, this is horrific.
Yeah.
Tombola or whatever that is. The 10 things you didn't know about Britney Spears. I'm like, I just want to read about Man United. I just want to scroll down here and find somewhere in between all these images that have just popped up is the article.
Yeah.
Whereas I buy the Athletic subscription, brilliant. The currency, brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. So I see exactly, look, I'm kind of biased, right? I'm your exact audience, but I'm kind of biased. But I just see that becoming more and more prevalent because you have infinite choice, and infinite choice is crippling.
Yeah. And it means, like, with a system like Outcaster, all of those publications could use the Outcaster technology as the technology to power their websites or power their apps. And you know, it's great to go in and find a brand that you really enjoy. Like The Currency, I think, is absolutely brilliant. And I read most things that get sent into my inbox from The Currency, and I love what they have done. I love their tone. I love their feel, everything. But the odd time I'll click onto a publication that's behind a paywall and I'll just want to read that one piece. And I might not,
independent.
But I might not know the publication well enough to convert.
Yeah.
80% of people who click onto a paywall click away. Right. That is a huge, huge, yeah. like, loss.
You've done the hard work, right? Yeah. The hard work is getting someone
there. The hard
work
is writing the headline that gets people yeah. in. Like, I always think there was this example in like the Telegraph, and it was some deep dive on Little Mix. And I was like, I want to read someone's 3,000 words on Little Mix just to see what is written. Like, I'm a Little Mix fan, but I was like, yes, give me an intellectual long read on Little Mix of this day. And it clicked on, and the Telegraph was like, you know, £5 a month, recurring revenue, recurring subscription. And I was like, God, the hassle it'll take me to unsubscribe from that. I know that's going to be a nightmare. So that's something we've addressed with Outcast.
And you can only ring.
You can only ring. So many of them you can only ring. It's a real dark tactic. And it's something that we've addressed from day one with Outcaster. It's as easy to unsubscribe as it is to subscribe, because I just think that you need to treat people carefully and cautiously, and thank people for their, you know, it takes a lot for someone to give you their money, even if it's only a euro or 2 euro. That's a lot to people, and be grateful for it, and make it easy for them to be able to stop paying you when they choose to. So that example where you click onto an article and you really just want to read that one piece, you're in the zone, you want to read it, and you don't want it to subscribe. Media companies and creators are losing so much income based on that 80% of people who are going to click away. Whereas with the Outcaster technology, you can buy that one piece. Mm. You can just click in and buy that one piece. And you might, like, you know, we're trying to bring down the processing fees on that, so that creators are still walking away with kind of close to 60, 70% of the revenue of that piece. But it's still something. Like, it's more than what you're losing. And it's also a growth technique as well. It's a nice growth tactic that someone can trial your content. Right now, the kind of the lowest we reduce that fee down to is like 50 cent. And we're seeing kind of like 15 out of that 50 cent can go into the creator's pockets when the process, we're obviously using like big payment processors, the more, you know, most famous one in the world, to be able to process the fees. So they still need to take their cut. So the smallest we can kind of get it down to is 15 cent of 50. But like, we're working on that always. And payment processors, I think, as well, as we move into a more democratized internet, payment processors won't be able to take huge fees anymore, because, you know, I understand they're providing a really, really good service, but they'll have to start looking at kind of what they're taking. Same, we were talking about this over at lunch with the App Store fees and things like that. Like, they're destroying content creators, they're destroying small businesses, startups, and the idea that they take 30% of any in-app purchase is really hindering growth, I think, and development. So, you know, we've managed to get around that with Outcaster, that the apps that are deployed are not downloaded from the app stores. And really proud to say that we are, you know, we will never have app store fees for our content creators, which is brilliant. But I think as we move into this kind of next phase of the internet, we'll start to see less of the typical tech giants who have performed well, and start to see definitely more democratized and more interesting startups coming out of it.
Before we go away from the female founder piece, I just want to talk about one thing and ask you a question. What would be the couple of things you would change about the current ecosystem to make it more favorable to female founders? Because I think there's always a value in, you know, if you're going to pose a problem, pose a solution with it. That's kind of my theory on everything. So you're in the space. What would be the couple of things? You mentioned equal funds. So 50-50 funds.
Equal funds.
What else? Even from people are listening, because we've a really diverse listenership in terms of we've VCs that listen, we've funds that listen, we've a lot of angels that listen. Mm-hmm. What would be the things you'd say, right, here's low-hanging fruit we can change right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are things that are happening in the background that are really worth noting. For instance, the NDRC pre-accelerator program makes a real effort to have parity in the cohort, which is brilliant, because you naturally then build up your community of female founders and you build up your people. So when you look, I suppose, what it is that founders need to be successful, it is mentorship, support, and cash. And you can get those, you get really great female support networks and female support circles and things like that, which are fantastic, but they're not necessarily always connected to the cat. So I definitely think one thing that will hugely help is, at the very least, I want to see a commitment from VCs that X amount of our cash is going to go to female founders or diverse founders or whatever it is to just make the ecosystem a little bit more diverse. When it's diversified, it'll feel safer for women. And that's when we'll start to see more people entering it. You know, right now, when you look, when you think of an entrepreneur that has secured cash in Ireland over the last 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, picture that person in your mind. What are you seeing? You're seeing...
You mentioned him a little while ago. Yeah, he just popped in my head for that reason.
You're seeing a white man with skinny jeans not wearing any socks. Like, it's just because that's what we see, that's what perpetuates, and that's what repeats itself. And in order for that to change, it's going to be the people at the top saying, do you know what? I don't want to see skinny jeans and a white t-shirt anymore. I want to see female founders. And a very, very good start would even to be able to say 10% of our available fund is going to go to female-founded companies within the next 18 months. We'll start to see real difference trickling down. Because right now, I'm pretty sure it's 2.8% globally. And I think Ireland is one of the lowest of where those VC funds go. Now, we are starting to see smaller VC funds that are female-focused emerge. We've got AXO from Berlin. We've got Pink Salt in the UK just announced their first fund the other day. Kim Kardashian announced a fund yesterday.
There you go.
Like, we're starting to see it kind of come to place, but it needs to be faster, and it needs to come from the institutional VCs that are there already in existence that have cash to deploy now, need to start investing in female founded companies and having female fund managers as well, actually making decisions at the top of the table, who are saying, I think this, you know, this needs to go here, and I can work with this person and I can advise them. So let's deploy the cash.
Cash really does change everything. We can talk about all the things we want, all the good initiatives, like, all that. Like, oh, we should have this kind of day. And
the morning routines.
I'm like, that's a bit tokenism. That's a bit kind of like, let's kind of pink wash our company with having a female founder day.
You cannot do this. You cannot do this without cash. You can't. Like, you cannot build a tech company at the scale and the speed. And for all I talk about, you know, time is key. Like, if we kept going the way we're going, we'll run out of cash. We need VC injection. We need them to give us that benefit to open up their networks to other startups and other kind of international networks as well, to put their little PR press machines behind us and to really put their money where their mouth is. And to, you know, for all intents and purposes, all the International Women's Day's good vibes and the female founders webinars, if you don't put cash behind it, they won't succeed.
Speaking of cash, you're raising.
We're raising.
See what I did there?
Thank you. That was such a good segue.
Such a pro.
You're natural. We are raising. We're out raising at the moment. We are looking for 1.5 million. That is to get us to a point where we'll be doing a Series A in about 12 months' time. We have raised a bit. We have commitments, but we are interested in speaking to any VCs who are interested in the content creation space, the creator economy, etc.
So peer into your crystal ball. What's the kind of content trend for the next kind of 12 to 18 months? You kind of hinted at it earlier there, but if people are, I always like to give people tangibles. Mm-hmm. I love people being able to walk away from the pod going, oh, you know what? I'm going to take immediate action. Great entrepreneurs take immediate action. So they're listening to a content expert here. What should they be looking at now in their business? Or if they're a content creator, what are the things they should be focusing on and going, right, start today?
I suppose one of the most tangible things for anyone who's in the content creator space, who's doing it independently or on behalf of a brand, video podcasts, you know, video. It's always video. The reason I'm saying not video is a groundbreaking thing, but video podcasts, we're seeing the most tangible link between seeing something on social and converting into an actual listener. So invest in some video podcasts, great visuals, and treat short form content like you would anything else. You know, really think about what that 30 seconds, 45 seconds is going to look like and going to say, and create for the form, and you'll see success from that as well. We'll start to, you know, I think in a wider consumer level, we will start to see more people wise up to content behind paywalls, content subscriptions, and multimedia content subscriptions, not just your kind of typical Substack model or your the odd thing behind Patreon, but really thinking about how the form meets the content and the overall, you know, user experience of consuming that content will be great. Yeah, I think that like there's a couple of things in the ether. You know, the advertising budgets have been on consistent decline over the last 4 years. They'll start to kind of bottom out this year. So we'll see less and less sponsored content from people. More that any advertising budgets that are kind of existing there are going into specific form stuff. So we're seeing less of advertisers, say, sponsor podcasts and doing branded podcasts, and more just putting the product in the hands of the creators and getting them where they are. Understanding each individual form, I think, is really important for content creators and brands and stuff like that. I mean, for brands, content creation, content marketing is still on the rise. It's so bloody powerful.
I think they still don't get it though. I think there's a lot of brands that still don't get it. I spoke at that marketing conference and I could tell some of them were just not drinking the Kool-Aid. They were kind of looking at me like I had 10 heads.
Well, here's a stat for any brand that doesn't get it, right? 66% of consumers right now are belief-driven consumers, which means they make their purchasing decisions based on the ethos, the values of the company, that is like one of the key drivers for them and who they're choosing to spend their money with. So if you're a brand that sits on the fence, that thinks it's okay to just like sit in your office now and not comment on the world or not get out there, then that's going to be your ruination. You have to be strong as a brand, get out, live by your values, you know, really kind of think about the overall company that you want to be, and all of those things. It's not just about your product anymore, really, when you're a brand. It's your product, it's your team, it's your values, it's your employer brand. It's like all of that stuff matters. Like, people want to spend their money with brands that are good, that are seen to be doing good things for the world.
Beautiful. But you look at, I like the little self-status at the end. It's a great point, right? You look at the likes of Gymshark. I always hold them up as a company going, look at the way they tell their story.
Yeah.
Look at the narrative, and they weave it right back. He's in the shed. He's doing his first couple of hand-pressed t-shirts. He was working as, you know, in Pizza Hut as a delivery guy. Yeah. Incredible. Like, and they are content driven.
Yeah.
They have a whole studio in their warehouse.
Yeah, but look how many, like, there's so many brands now coming from their first step is content. Like, they're starting in content and they're growing brands out of it, or it's like it's really part of their success story. I think that you when you look at, say, TikTok, which I know most people look at and they say, well, that's an app for kids or whatever else. TikTok is one of the first social media platforms in many, many years that people are using as a search engine. So like Instagram and Facebook and all are great for a little peruse and a browse and stuff like that. But people are going to TikTok and being like, how do I make salmon? How do I build a home pool? You know, they're looking at things. So they're going to start searching for, what should I be wearing? You know, best runners for the gym. It's user generated recommendations. So you have to be within that space or creating content around that space. Think of your short form content as you would your SEO content, because the strategies that you implemented there for Google and SEO will apply now to social. And if TikTok are doing it, Instagram will do it and the rest will follow.
That's an incredible point. I hadn't actually thought of that about TikTok, because it just naturally serves me up. Oh, we were talking about it earlier. Yeah. Guy transforms his backyard. And I'm like, that's just so compelling. Yeah.
But again, trust your own consumption habits, because when you go to TikTok and you're looking for something, you're looking for an answer for something, or you're trying to get recommended, even if it's searching for something that's trending, like, people are using the search function and the recommendation function on TikTok in a way that they don't use the search functions on other social media. So just think about that. Yeah.
Gems to live by. Final question for you. Do you have a book that you would recommend that's had an impact on you personally or professionally?
The Artist's Way is great. You're interested in content creation or just creative pursuits in general. And Atomic Habits.
It's a gem.
It's good.
Yeah. It's the one I keep recommending to people.
It's just so good. Break down your mindset and, like, you know, the stories we tell ourselves. You know, for years I would have said I'm not disciplined. I'm very you know, compulsive, and I'm creative, and I like to act, you know, in a creative thing, you know, whereas I was like, oh, the defined work day of like a kind of timetable wouldn't work for me in my mind. But you read Atomic Habits and understand that like you can really not train yourself, but you can create any sort of routine for yourself or habits for yourself that work.
I think entrepreneurs are like that. We like to think of ourselves as mavericks, that we're like, oh, I'm this creative beast and I don't set a timetable. And as you get a bit older as well, you're like, I need a schedule.
Yeah.
I need a routine.
I was only thinking this the other day. Do you know when you're like growing up in school and you're like, I could never do a 9-to-5 in an office. And, you know, being an entrepreneur, you're often like, you know, you're away from your desk or you're answering emails at like 9 o'clock at night. The other day I was like, I would love a 9-to-5.
We always crave what we don't have though. We always look at go, oh, the grass is greener over there. But I think especially for entrepreneurs, Atomic Habits is powerful because when you don't have that structure, sometimes you'd love, like you said there, you'd love someone to go, okay, Cassie, today just do these 5 things. You're like, sweet.
Yeah.
Because that's often the hardest thing is like, I just don't know what to be focusing on.
That's it. Yeah.
I've a list 100 things. I know a couple are really, really important, but I'm not sure where the other 3 rank. You just want someone to go, here you go. Atomic Habits is incredibly powerful. Where can people learn more about you, about the various companies you run?
Yeah. So the best place to get me, if you want to make contact, is Cassie, C-A-S-S-I-E at outcaster.io. I'm putting that out there for any VCs, angels, et cetera, who would like to make contact, or content creators who are interested in learning more about the platform, or any, I love chatting to content creators who are starting out, who want a little bit of advice. Love having sit down coffees with people and going through a few bits. And I'm on all social media platforms at Cassie Lorraine.
Brilliant. It's been an absolute pleasure, Cassie.
Thank you, Gary.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.